Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we are going to speak about the situation of Ukrainian refugees. This episode is part of our series on the war in Ukraine, and I am glad to welcome for this conversation our research analyst, Pauline Vail. Hi, Pauline. Thanks a lot for joining. How are you?
I'm very good, Giuseppe. Good to be here. Thanks.
You have co-written a paper with our senior fellow Uri Dadush asking the question whether Ukrainian refugees will return back home. As the war is unfolding, the issue of refugees has taken a very large scale. Ukraine, which is a country of over 40 million people, has seen about 15% of its population flee the country. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, since the Russian invasion in February, 13 million people are stranded in areas affected by the conflict. 8 million are internally displaced, and another 6.8 million are recorded as refugees in third countries. Of those refugees, most to neighboring countries, already 3.9 million Ukrainian refugees are officially registered in EU countries. This is a very superficial snapshot about what has been going on since March. Could you perhaps kick off our conversation today by providing some additional information to our listeners about this wave and crisis that is being unfolded across the continent?
Yeah, for sure. I think you provided a very good broad introduction to what is going on. I think the two most interesting features about this wave of refugees is, one, its speed, and second, its smooth legal aspect. So on the question of the speed, and it's the speed and the magnitude. This is indeed the biggest influx of refugees that the European continent has ever seen, and over such a short period. That is to say that the figures you just gave of 6.8 people being registered refugees has been more or less the same for the last couple of months. So that means that the invasion happened on February 24, and in the first 2 months already, this 15% of the Ukrainian population had fled. That's the first main aspect, I think. The second aspect that I think is important is the fact that the EU really stepped up its capacity to welcome refugees, in the sense that it's, as opposed to previous situations of a humanitarian crisis, it has actually decided to welcome the refugees. And what it means in practice is that it has prompted what is called the Temporary Protection Directive, which automatically grants Ukrainian people who have fled the country access to basic rights and services in the EU. And so this kind of legal certainty really allows the Ukrainians to settle. That means that children can go to school and people can right away start looking for a job. So yeah, that's really what the two things I want to underline, the size and speed, and also the fact that everything was organized so that Ukrainians could be assimilated as fast as possible. Well, assimilated maybe is not the right word, but welcomed and start a new life in the EU as soon as possible.
Thank you. In your paper, you're trying to ask a question which is quite a difficult one, especially because the war is still ongoing, and it's very hard to look into the future. But you're trying to see if a huge number, I mean, most of the number that have fled Ukraine will return, or asking yourself the question if families will eventually be reunited abroad, and possibly implying an even greater inflows of Ukrainian into Europe or elsewhere when the war is over. I know this is a bit the bigger question that you have in the paper, but basically what I wanted to ask to you is, first of all, how you've tried to answer this question, and then what you are finding out.
Of course. So again, this was indeed the angle that we chose in the paper, which is, I mean, we cannot forecast the future of course, but we tried to provide an intellectual framework building on the literature and building on what the way other people in such situations have behaved in the past. The first thing to realize is that a refugee is someone seeking shelter in a third country. But once this person has managed to be away from a situation of danger for themselves, they tend to act as economic migrants. That is to say that as any human beings, they will try to organize to have the best life possible. And so it's in this kind of thinking that we just realized that Ukraine is one of the, if not the poorest country in Europe. And so that means that when Ukrainians go to, for instance, Poland, whatever job they get, the wages are 3 to 4 times higher than any wage they could ever get in Ukraine. And this is for Poland. But of course, for countries with higher GDPs in Europe, like France and Germany, the magnitude is even higher. So that's what we anticipated. The fact that if the war, I mean, again, of course, we cannot foresee how long the war would last, but if families manage to, you know, find a job, have children at school, and make a better living, we anticipated that they might stay, or essentially that they might reunite, because as you know, nearly 90% of the refugees are women or children, basically. And the second thing that we thought was very interesting that also confirmed this intuition that Ukrainians would stay is looking at Ukraine pre-war. So Ukraine is a lower middle income country with a specific feature that is to be located very close to countries that are much richer than it is. And because of this, when you can compare Ukraine to other countries with the same levels of GDP per capita, the share of its population living abroad or the weight of remittances in its GDP is really high. And essentially, it's similar to other countries like Moldova, which are in this same kind of situations. To give you an idea, Ukraine has the GDP per capita PPP that is similar to that of Sri Lanka. But because of this capacity that Ukrainians have had to go make a living in Poland, they have been displaying already a high propensity to immigrate. The interesting thing also, and that's what we wanted to underline in the paper, is that it's not all black and white. The question is not only will they just stay in Europe and meaning, you know, give up completely on Ukraine. Of course not. But this geographic proximity also gives a third option, essentially. It gives the option of what we call pendular migrations, what Ukrainians have been doing for a lot of years now with to Poland, for instance, estimated at 1.34 million people. So it's Ukrainians that go to Poland for a seasonal job or for a short-term contract and then go back to Ukraine to spend their money and to live there, essentially. And because of that, we think that at the very least, we should see that Ukrainians will choose to keep a footing in the European countries where they found shelter.
Just one thing on this, Pauline, because that's more like a general trend of pendularism in these countries that you're highlighting. But even in the actual circumstances of the war, there have been recorded cross-border movements going back and forth. If I understand correctly, it hasn't been just an exodus, a one-way exodus, but there have been already, even during the war, some back and forth. Have you looked at the back and forth that are happening also already now? What kind of relation they are with this pendularism? Because I imagine that the circumstances are completely different from a normal pendularism migration that you are highlighting.
Of course, of course. So I think so two things I would like to underline. First is that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence on this, but it's hard to have strict numbers. So what the UNHCR records is the border crossings. So indeed, we see huge numbers of border crossings, but so far, there's no macro data that can say for sure that this person goes back, stays 5 days and comes back, because we just record when someone comes and goes. What these border crossings mean in practice is hard to know for sure. But I think also what is the interesting difference between what is happening now and the pendular migration that I was describing before is that it's really not the same people. Usually what we have in the case of economic migrants, it's we're going to have men, working age men, either single or leaving their family at home, who go get a job, make a better living, and either just send the remittances or go to live with their family for some part of the year. Here we have a completely different situation where it's mostly women and children that are in Europe, and also a lot of the elderly population that has been left behind. So for all we know, maybe it's people who are going to see their relatives. Maybe it's already people who are working in Europe and going back to already help with the reconstruction in the places where war is not ongoing anymore. And to build on this, actually, that's why we make the difference and we really underline and we call it registered refugees. Because a registered refugee means someone who went to the country where they are to acknowledge their presence and to basically request access to these basic rights. So that means that if they have kids, they go to school. And if kids go to school every Monday morning, that means that there might be some back and forth, but essentially they are still choosing to be in the country for some part of the year at least.
I see. So your overall analysis is trying to also answer this question about the implications that these movements are going to have for Ukraine in the longer term. And also you start to speculate about how this relates to future reconstruction efforts, for instance. I know that it is always very hard to speak about reconstructions in the middle of the war as we stand at the moment, but it is also an important exercise in order to prepare the ground for what is going to happen after. So what has been your take on this relation?
Well, when we discussed this paper with some of our colleagues, one of the interesting comments that came out was the perception that we were talking from the point of view of the refugee, which might somehow be opposed to that of Ukraine. Because if we forecast that, you know, all of the people that have fled are going to stay away, so that's 15% of the population. And if families reunite, that means an even larger outflow of people out of Ukraine, which could beg the question of who is going to rebuild. And I think it would be interesting to just go beyond this view. First, like you said, I mean, there's obviously the highest level of uncertainty on the duration of the war. Still, what we do see is that Russia at the moment occupies regions where 20% of the Ukrainian population used to live. They occupy regions that are important in terms of trade with access to the sea, that are important in terms of agriculture production, but also in terms of mineral productions. And these are the core of the Ukrainian GDP. And so in that sense, I think it's in everyone's interest if Ukrainians go elsewhere to make a living and then, like we said, are able to come back and participate in the reconstruction effort. Also, what the literature shows importantly is that a refugee that is coming back to their country without having, quote, you know, succeeded abroad is actually coming back being a weight on the country, because it comes back to needing a job in the labor market that is already highly saturated or highly just in an economy that is not working well. It's also coming there weighing on a state that is weak and also, you know, burdened by these reconstruction efforts. So in that sense, then again, we cannot foresee everything, but my take is that with remittances, with this, the legal and economic power that welcoming properly refugees in Europe give to them would actually in the long term benefit Ukraine. And also, I think the example of Poland is an interesting one. You know, for instance, Poland, when they joined the EU, a lot of Polish people went further west to go seek higher wages. And since then, now we've had a lot of Ukrainians going to Poland to seek higher wages. So what I mean to say is that in the long term, when Ukraine rebuilds and its growth pick up, even if a sizable share of its population lives in Europe, it will still attract other migrants from further east. And so we shouldn't see it in such.
So you're basically saying that because there is a virtuous circle over there about the Ukrainian refugees integrating and eventually giving remittance back to their own country, this might be definitely a positive force for the reconstruction of Ukraine. And as well, further integration of Ukrainian refugees within the countries, the hosting countries, would allow less saturation. We all know that there's going to be big problems with the aftermath of the war when it comes to the labor markets, but this should provide some sort of not waiting that much on that front. But then the natural questions after that would be the implications for the receiving countries, because obviously we're speaking about EU countries which have been receiving already waves of refugees in the past, and therefore it's interesting to understand what you and Uri in your paper you've been analyzing about the other side of the story, how this would play out in those economies of the hosting places.
Yes, for sure, you're right. So essentially what I was saying before is that from Ukraine's perspective, creating incentive programs to push return doesn't make economic or humanitarian sense. From the perspective of the European countries hosting a lot of refugees, I think there's been a lot of commentary underlining that the political or the social appraisal of these refugees has been very different from refugees that, for instance, from Afghanistan or
Syria, yeah,
and anywhere in the Middle East that we've received. And I think also that the commentary that was very obvious before was that economically, from the point of view of the needs and potential benefits for receiving countries, well, the EU needs and benefits greatly from refugees, maybe from an economic perspective or, you know, from a social and cultural perspective. And so this time around, we, for the first time, have the political will, and finally, there's no need to spend a huge amount of political capital to be able to welcome properly refugees. So that's kind of this alignment of interest that we see from the geopolitical aspect and economic aspect. Then again, to the question of how can these countries deal? A country like the one like Poland, they are receiving a very, very large amount of people. In the first 2 months of the war, the new Ukrainian population to Poland was a bigger number than the whole population of Krakow.
That's quite impressive.
That's quite impressive, exactly. But so what that tells us actually is that because this wave was so big and so fast, of course, the absorption moment will take some frictions in the sense that there is some social services saturation. All of EU countries are supposed to grant basic rights, but in practice don't actually have the social service capacity to essentially do it. We have private people hosting people, a lot of this relying on civil society organizations. And so these are short-term issues. In the short term also, we see that for the EU countries, this is the moment where it's going to have the highest fiscal cost. One of our colleagues tried to look at the literature, and essentially, the estimates is that a refugee costs 15,000 euros a year to
the economy, to the hosting country.
Exactly. And so these are the things that happen in the first year. But ultimately, you know, after just a few years already, these people who are working age, highly educated, because Ukrainian population is actually better educated, like at least a higher level than the European population. These profiles are also people that are highly willing to work. That is to say that they often end up working in really basic jobs that are below their potential education level. But there's this willingness to work that in practice show that they benefit greatly to the hosting economy. For instance, since 2015, there's been around 1.4 million Ukrainians living in Poland. So that's kind of the same amount of new Ukrainians that have just gotten to Poland, and estimates are that it added 0.8% of GDP annually in the past 5 years, you know? And so in the sense, it's to say that the biggest fiscal effort is being done now, and in the long term, it will benefit. And last point to underline is that in all EU countries, and especially in Eastern EU countries, actually, we have very low unemployment rates. And we have a labor force that is shrinking. So we mechanically need and benefit from this inflow of people.
Well, these are very good economic arguments, but you mentioned before, and there is a political aspect to all this, and there is an advantage in this situation where Ukrainian refugees have received more sympathy for the particular circumstances of what we are in. However, I wonder, because we are here speaking about mostly EU countries, how all this that we have at the moment could change the debate over the EU common European asylum system. It's perhaps more of a legal question on the policy side, but it's extremely connected to all the issues that you've mentioned about how we deal with the European frame for that, because we've been seeing a huge effort from specific countries for that specific crisis, but also we will see all the crisis unfolding in the next future. So how do we take stock of this in order to be better equipped?
I mean, it's a very interesting question. It's a legal one, but then again, I think it's mostly a political one. And I think what is commonly agreed upon is that Ukrainian refugees are just facing less racism than other refugees have had to suffer in the past. Secondly, we are in the middle of a war against Russia that the EU, which is at the border of the EU, which is a war against EU values. So there's also this sense of Europe is also at war with Russia, right? So this supposedly is also just part of a war effort. So then again, you ask, what does it mean for the future? It's hard to say. This temporary protection directive that I mentioned, which, you know, facilitates greatly the access to the refugee status for people fleeing conflict, has existed since 2001. It's the first time we use it. Why is that? It's because the Visegrad countries, so countries of Eastern Europe, such as Poland and Hungary, had been vetoing it, you know, since the start, and because it had been put forward at the EU Council for the Syrian crisis, and there was no political capital or no political will to do it. And also we tried to foresee what would happen to the Ukrainian refugees, for instance. This directive, it grants refugees rights in the EU for up to 3 years in its current framework. So it would need some legal reforming, but essentially this is not where the hurdle is. The question is, what will be the political situation? What will populism be thriving on at that moment? To either push to, of course, extend it, because it would make no sense to carry fiscally the burden of welcoming them for 3 years and then in 3 years telling them to go home, or will they be so more realism? And it's hard to foresee. And then you asked about other situations, other conflicts. It's hard for us to, we didn't try to anticipate this.
No, of course, but this is definitely a conversation that it becomes open. And of course, your paper allows us to have an analysis, which is, in my opinion, it's interesting for the case that we have right now with the Ukrainian refugees, but it's something that can help to guide us or steer us, in any case, inform the broader conversation on the impact of refugees and their status in Europe, which is something that it's not going to go away in the few next months, and it's not just linked to the current crisis. We are almost at the end of this episode, Pauline, and I would like to ask if there is anything that I might have forgotten from your analysis that it would be particularly important to tell to our listeners before we leave and say goodbye.
Let me think. Maybe two things. First, I completely agree with you that the hope is that this crisis sets standards of how we treat people seeking shelters, because maybe for political, geopolitical or climate reasons, refugees are here to stay.
Unfortunately.
Yes. And maybe I will leave you with one of the recommendations that we really wanted to highlight in the paper. And that also, I think, bridges to what you were asking about the legal organization of hosting refugees, is that in order also to facilitate a smooth absorption of the shock, what is going to be important in the EU in coming years and months is to facilitate movement for these refugees, as so far they have access to basic rights in the country they are registered, but not automatically in the EU as a whole. And the strength of the EU as a single market is this freedom of movement. And refugees will benefit and will benefit to themselves and to the hosting economies the most if they can move to where there's the most labor opportunities. That also goes with a whole lot of measures on recognizing their skills and facilitating all legal and administrative aspects. But we really wanted to underline the idea that even for future waves of refugees, making people stuck in one country is just counterproductive on all aspects.
Thank you, Pauline, and on these words, which I very much share with you, we have unfortunately to say goodbye. And in any case, we will keep the conversation alive with our series of podcasts and analysis dedicated to the war in here at Bruegel. So I would like also to remind our listeners that you will find in the show notes the link to the paper co-written by Uri and Pauline on the topic. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.